Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, January 5th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMED. In tonight's news, update on Friday's Arcata fire from Chief of the Arcata Fire District. Humboldt County's Public Defender's Office receives grant to expand holistic defense services. And this week's weather report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
On Friday, January 2nd, at around 2:30 p.m., a fire broke out in downtown Arcata in the 800 block on 10th Street, spreading quickly because of strong winds. Even with a quick response from the fire department, the damages were severe. 7 businesses, along with several apartments, were leveled, and 5 other businesses sustained damage from heat, smoke, or water damage. The total damage is believed to be around $18 million, but could still change as assessments continue. KMUD News talked with Chris Emmons, the fire chief for the Arcata Fire District. He shared the timeline of the response, the damage, and how it was finally contained.
I was called in initially by one of our fire engines that was coming back from a medical aid, a previous call they had had right around 2:30 in the afternoon on Friday, and they were driving up G Street in Arcata, and they saw a large amount of smoke. Well, any smoke in the downtown area is concerning, but they saw a large amount of smoke, and they called the Cal Fire Dispatch Center, ECC, that we use for dispatch services, and that company officer requested a full commercial fire response. And he didn't even have the exact location yet, and he was just driving to the smoke. And as he was driving, the emergency command center was advising him that they were receiving calls on it at that point. And he pulled up and found a heavy fire between 2 buildings, and it was already spreading laterally through the structures.
This became a coordinated effort through Humboldt County's mutual aid system, with efforts from different state and local departments and agencies.
We had resources, both state and local resources, from CAL FIRE and then local government agencies as well, all the way from Trinidad CAL FIRE, as far south as Wiyot CAL FIRE that came in, and then a lot of the local government agencies in between, such as Riedel, Ferndale, Fortuna, Lolita, Fieldbrook, Blue Lake, Neyland, Humboldt Bay, I'm sure I'm missing somebody. I don't have all my notes in front of me. But Samoa was there, and it was it was quite the mutual aid draw. So you can imagine driving time from those various locations throughout the county in a fire engine. It's obviously slower than a car. And I do know, I just found out today actually, that while one of the agencies, I believe, was responding from the Eel River Valley, they actually drove up on a car accident that they had to stop at and handle while they were en route to this, or en route to the fire. So, yeah, there was a lot of things going on all at once. We ended up with about 80, I think it was about 80 firefighters, fire suppression personnel, and then there was probably another 20 to 30 support personnel from various agencies, non-fire agencies, City of Arcata, just folks from various entities and agencies that showed up to help us out.
The start of the fire was believed to be from a gas line, but the actual cause of the fire is still an ongoing investigation.
So basically, the way it works, there's gas lines all through the city underground and everything, and those gas lines go up to the buildings and businesses. And from that point on, they go into a manifold, and it gets reduced down to either residential or commercial business service. So it was on the service side, not the PG&E. I'm sorry, it was on the business side, not the PG&E service side. There's a manifold there, and from the fire, we're still looking at this, but from the fire, it looks like what happened was the meter had melted away, and this caused it to free flow, and there was no way. We normally shut the gas off at the meter when we get on scene. Well, there was no way at that point to shut that gas off, so it just kept fueling the fire. The valve was no longer in place at that point. So what we had to do is have PG&E come in, and where they wanted to initially shut it off, it was too dangerous for them to get in there because the building was already leaning out over the street, and they were going to have to dig up that section of the street. They were able to move back probably about 100 feet into the intersection, and they were able to dig that up. But we had to, ensure that they were, you know, they're not firefighters. We had to ensure that they were going to be safe doing their stuff, and they dug up that large gas main, and they crimped that off to shut off the gas to that entire block. So I know a lot of folks, there's a lot of rumors out there that it was caused by PG&E, but it wasn't. It was the failure of the meter that we had to get that shut off so that we could extinguish the fire. And not that that was the cause of the fire. They're still investigating the cause of the fire, but that meter was certainly making it difficult for us to put the fire out and the wind on top of it.
Evans explained the approach fire teams took and how it evolved as the fire continued.
We have what we call an offensive strategy or a defensive strategy. So offensive strategy is we go interior, we're trying to fight the fire, trying to knock the fire down, evacuate folks, and we're very aggressive. That's where we're risking a lot to save a lot. But when we transition to a defensive, what we're doing is we're acknowledging that we're not going to be able to stop it with the resources we have, and we need to regroup and protect the surrounding areas. So we started very aggressive. We had people inside. We actually had structural collapse with our firefighters inside. And there's actually videos of firefighters coming off the roof, and even when there's people on the roof and then firefighters still inside, the folks that just as they came off the roof, there was already roof collapse happening right behind them. So it was actually a very close call for the firefighters in that they were trying really hard, but it was such an intense fire spreading rapidly. We transitioned to a defensive situation, and that's where we're trying to protect the other surrounding blocks.
The immediate threat ended around 8 p.m. that night, but according to Emmons, fire crews were still finding hot pockets around the area the next morning.
The next day, we still had hot pockets that we were mopping up, but I would say where the immediate threat to the rest of the blocks, it was probably, I'm going to say it was probably about 8 o'clock-ish that night, where the immediate threat was no longer there, but obviously we were on scene all night working on hot spots. We didn't want any flare-ups. There was still wind, and there was so much ember cast within the wind, the convection column in the wind. We were finding embers that were dropping on rooftops a couple blocks away, so we were putting resources on the rooftops of buildings that were to the north a couple blocks away.
Thankfully, there were no injuries from this fire, but the Arcata Fire District and the Arcata Police Department had to evacuate people in the area. Even though the fire is out, there's still long-term damage that needs to be fixed in and around downtown Arcata.
So some of the nearby buildings, like across the street, there were other businesses and buildings that took, we call it, it's radiant heat. It's the heat that, it's not direct flame, but it's radiant heat coming from the fire, caused blistering, caused windows to crack and break. The soot from the smoke, if you're down in the downtown area around the Minor Theater, you can actually see where the soot was hitting the upper levels of the building, and you can see where it's darkened from that. So there were multiple businesses down there, and just the smoke alone getting inside of the buildings, through ventilation systems and things like that, it created smells in them that weren't pleasant. And then there was also, because of the amount of water that was used, like Ace Hardware had flooding from the runoff from the scene that, or from the fire that went into their other store there on the block. So we were able to get some, put some damming and diking in there to help divert the water away from the store, but it did get into the store and flood parts of it.
Emmons confirmed that the fire investigation is still ongoing and probably won't be completed for another couple of weeks.
Specifically to the fire district, we're still conducting the investigation. We're working in conjunction with the Humboldt County Fire Arson Investigation Unit, as we're a part of that. The Arcata Police Department's working with us on everything, too. We're not suspecting arson. We're not suspecting anything specific. It's just that's part of our team that we work out. I know a lot of folks think that once we call the police department in, it automatically makes it arson, and that's not it at all. It's just that we need all those resources to work together. They're helping us with the interviews, collection of videos, things like that. So we're working through the investigation process right now. As far as the scene cleanup and everything, that's going to be worked through City of Arcata, County of Humboldt, and actually State OES, because there was with all the paint and everything involved there, we're worried about the environmental cleanup that's involved with that. So we've actually requested assistance from the state. I say we, it's everybody involved together from the state to help us work through that process to get the site cleaned up and everything.
Emmons finished the interview thanking the community and the county with their help and support.
My only thing is we're so gracious, and I know I'm speaking for the city of Arcata on this too, but we're so gracious for all of our allied partners that came and helped us during this, and the community itself. I mean, this is a huge tragedy for the community, and it's the community support that we've been seeing has just been tremendous, and, you know, the one thing I will say is the folks in Arcata and the surrounding areas are, Arcata's resilient, and the people in the surrounding areas are just the outreach and the support has been tremendous for the people that lost their homes, lost their businesses, and just the community in general. That's tremendous, and it makes me feel good to live here.
Displaced residents are urged to contact the Red Cross at 707-496-8278 or 707-832-5480 for help with temporary housing and additional resources. Anyone with information on the fire, reach out to Arcata Fire District at 707-825-2000 or the Arcata Police Department's Investigation Unit at 707-822-2424. The Humboldt County Public Defender's Office was recently awarded a grant from the Office of the State Public Defender's Expanded Public Defense Grant. The grant total was $743,864, and will be used to expand holistic defense services in Humboldt County. KMUD News talked with Luke Brownfield, the Chief Public Defender of Humboldt County. He explained what holistic defense is, why it is needed, and how it will be used.
Holistic defense is kind of like treating the whole person who's accused of a crime, not just the case. I'm trying to look at what has brought the person into the criminal justice, the root cause, seeing if there's any way to solve that issue rather than just defending the case in the typical lock them up method. And then the grant, the holistic defense grant, we're going to use it to get at least one additional social worker, a mitigation specialist, basically try to help our clients figure out what caused them to become a part of the legal justice system in the first place, and hopefully keep them from staying in the legal system.
He went into more detail explaining the need for this approach.
In practice, what it's going to mean is more time of trying to figure out how we can help our clients stay in the legal justice system, or how we can get them out of it. It'll be a lot of diagnosing what the issues are, whether it be mental health, drug treatment, housing, any of those issues, and figuring out what they need and how we can help facilitate getting them the support that they need.
And
so it'll be a lot of getting people to rehabs, mental health centers, finding housing, making sure they're on the medications, basically trying to prevent people to, finding alternatives to incarceration.
The grant money will be used to get a new social worker, a mitigation specialist, and an investigator to figure out the logistics of getting people to their appointments, including court and treatments. The plan is to have all positions work with the Public Defender's Office, figuring out approach and strategy for each client.
For each case, we work as a team. So the attorney is usually the first one to meet the client. If the attorney believes that a social worker or investigation or anything else could be helpful, then he brings in that social worker or investigator. He or she brings them in. And then they'll get involved, see if they agree with the attorney on, whether it be drug rehab, mental health services, whether they need housing, counseling, any kind of things that could help the client. Then the social worker and or the investigator will get involved with that. Usually for most of those things, it would be the social worker working alongside with the attorney. So for each client, we work as a team, and usually all three parties are involved in each case.
Brownfield explained the long-term goals of this program, finding different alternatives to incarceration, mainly community-based solutions.
So the long-term goal for us is finding alternatives to incarceration. Holistic defense would encourage diversion, restorative justice, as other community-based solutions rather than simply putting somebody in jail or prison. The hope is to keep that person in the community with their family. And then by doing that, you save the Humboldt County resources. And having somebody in local jail or in prison is expensive for the community. If there's safe alternatives to having somebody locked up, then it's far better for the community. It's far better for our clients. It's far better for everybody involved. So what this grant will do will allow us to explore getting more people into treatment-based alternatives to incarceration.
He expressed excitement for this grant and how it will create progress and new opportunities for the Public Defender's Office and Humboldt at large. The National Weather Service in Eureka updated their website for the weather forecast. These updates include the rainfall forecast for tonight and a flood watch warning for the Navarro River. KMUD talked with Josh Wood, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Eureka. He discussed the updates and what the forecast will look like for the rest of the week. He shared there was a winter storm warning, but it expired today. That warning was mainly for Scott Mountain Pass up in Highway 3. There is also a flood watch for Navarro River in effect from this evening to late tonight. The flood watch says the impact will include, quote, flooding of Highway 128 approximately 5 miles east of Highway 1 is certain, and the road will be closed. Motorists should use alternate routes, end quote. Woods went into more detail about the flood watch.
The Russian River Hopland has entered minor flood stage and is expected to remain in there through Tuesday morning and then subside.
He then looked at the near-term and extended forecast for Humboldt this week.
For the near term, we're looking at steady, moderate to some heavy rain in southern Lake and southern Mendocino counties through tonight. And that's contributing to some minor urban and small stream flooding. In the extended forecast, we'll be looking at light rainfall moving in late Tuesday through Wednesday. Most of that will be focused north through Del Norte County with much lighter rain south. Then we look to enter a extended period of clear, drying weather to wrap up the week and through the weekend, likely. Warming temperatures.
To stay up to date with local weather updates, visit weather.gov/EKA/. In state news, California gets new rules in 2026 on ICE, cell phone, and more. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
New California laws going into effect in 2026 are intended to bring positive change to schools on a range of issues. One bill requires schools to notify parents when immigration officers come onto a campus. Another prohibits the disclosure of student or parent data without the family's consent unless ICE has a judicial warrant. Yasmin Imani McMorrin is Director of Education Equity for Children's Defense Fund, California.
What is important is ensuring that our school campuses are safe and that information is getting out to parents. We are checking information and ensuring that everyone is following the rules.
Assembly Bill 1454 would update reading curricula to improve literacy, particularly among English language learners. Assembly Bill 3216 requires all K-12 schools to have a policy to limit or ban student use of cell phones during the school day by July 1st. McMorrin also applauds Senate Bill 640, which directs the Cal State University system to automatically admit qualified high school graduates without them having to apply.
The more supports that we have for our young folks to be successful and the more resources that we are allocating towards that, the better.
And Assembly Bill 1264 takes effect in 2026, requiring school districts to revamp their menus to remove the most harmful ultra-processed foods from school lunches by 2035. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Homelessness policy changes pose difficulties for unhoused elders. KPFA's Sharon Sabata reports.
It's very cold.
That's Sunday Wallace, a woman in her 50s who's been bouncing from city to city in the San Francisco Bay Area for nearly a decade.
I've been unhoused since 2016. 2026 will be 10 years homeless here living on the streets.
Wallace says she always has to keep moving.
I try to accommodate and switching around, going to different places so I can brush my teeth and wash my face, etc. kind of way, but I get put out of places. such as Starbucks.
It's become even trickier for Wallace since Starbucks reversed its policy in January of 2025, making it mandatory for everyone inside of the store to make a purchase and authorizing baristas or Starbucks staff to call the police on those who don't comply. To stay clean,
they go to Planet Fitness to shower sometimes in downtown San Francisco.
To catch a nap or warm up on a cold winter day, Wallace sometimes resorts to BART. But even that is about to get more expensive.
Yes, I have Robart to stay warm or to sleep. I have Robart to give me some sleep at times because there's been times I haven't had enough sleep.
Because people keep waking you up and sending you along? Or what happens?
Oh, no, that just happens in this material kind of way and being homeless.
Yeah.
Kind of tough to stick out.
So now BART prices are going to go up by 6%. So a longer ride might be 40 cents more expensive. A shorter one might be 15 cents more expensive. How does that impact you?
It heavily does impact me right now, especially in being homeless and not having food stamps. But I was thinking to write a letter to my social service worker and showing the rise of costs for BART, transportation.
So you don't have food stamps?
Not at this time, I don't.
So what does Wallace do for money?
Currently, I just have my SSI and my SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance, and I'm receiving it for mental schizophrenia, mental health.
And while she does have a mental health diagnosis, it's been a while since she's seen a doctor.
Yes, I see my doctor, and I have my psychiatrist, Dr. David Chu. I haven't seen him in a minute, but I intend to see him.
In this way, Wallace isn't alone. As the National Institute of Health says that as many as a third of unhoused people have un- or undertreated mental health conditions such as schizophrenia. While Wallace says she's not able to stay in any one place for very long, she counts her blessings for what she does have, and she says she sets a New Year's resolution every year.
I receive $1,335.81.
And that's probably not quite enough to pay for rent and all.
No, that wouldn't be. It wouldn't be because I'm going to need that federal assistance voucher to reduce the 30% deductible cut so I can afford it to pay rent.
Finally, what's your New Year's resolution?
To get a house, to have an apartment, to have a roof over my head. Yes. That self-preservation continue. I just need to continue to finish up with myself and I will have it.
For Pacifica, KPFA, I'm Sharon Sabota.
In national news, January 1st, 2026 was World Day of Peace. Pope Leo XIV and UN Chief Gutierrez deliver New Year's messages. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
In his message for the 59th World Day of Peace, Pope Leo XIV warned that in today's world, justice and human dignity are at an alarming risk amid global power imbalances. He spoke to a crowd at St. Peter's Square at noon.
In questa giornata, preghiamo tutti insieme.
On this day, let us all pray together for peace. First, among nations bloodied by conflict and suffering, but also within our homes, in families wounded by violence or pain.
Over at the United Nations, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a video statement on the new year. Just days earlier, on December 29th, Guterres had warned that, in his words, the world stands at a crossroads. He urged world leaders to get priorities straight, noting conflict, climate breakdown, and systemic violations of international law, while global military spending soared by 10%. He said a safer world begins by investing more in fighting poverty and less in fighting wars. His New Year's message took the form of a call to action.
In 2026, I call on leaders everywhere, get serious, choose people and planet over pain, and I urge everyone who hears this message, play your part. Our future depends on our collective courage to act. This new year, let's rise together for justice, for humanity, for peace.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Monday is the deadline for the public to weigh in on a potential rule change by the EPA that could impact which water bodies may be protected from pollution. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, tribes are among those asking for a 30-day extension to comment.
WOTUS, or the Waters of the United States, guides which resources fall under the Federal Clean Water Act. But as written, the EPA would narrow the law's enforcement, with estimates suggesting that 80% of the nation's wetlands could be at risk.
I think it's a big picture concern for everyone, really. Most tribes who want clean water or the ability to make sure that water is usable are probably going to write in opposition to kind of what the rule stands for.
Daniel Cordalis is Diné and runs the nonprofit Tribal Water Institute. While tribes can regulate waters on their reservations, they lack jurisdiction elsewhere.
Tribes can't look to the EPA anymore. And arguably, the federal government has to protect these tribal resources, but who's going to do that?
Some states are stepping up, like Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona.
That we're coordinating with our neighbors, tribes or states or country on our southern border to make sure that we each know what each other is doing.
Trevor Bagori is the Water Quality Division Director at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality.
Hopefully this new rule will add some clarity as long as they are able to provide scientific tools to help us determine what's regulated and what's not.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Attendance at a school near the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations has nearly doubled in the past 3 years. School leaders say they're engaging one-on-one with students and families. They're also implementing Lakota language and culture. South Dakota Searchlight's Megan O'Brien has more.
It'd be like a herd of horses coming in.
There you are. Where you been?
This is a typical morning at Norris Elementary, where most of the students are Native American. Principal Brian Brown greets students and staff at the cafeteria tables as breakfast is served. Brown also asks teachers who's missing. It's a way of getting ahead of the problem, he says. When students aren't at school, he makes phone calls and home visits. Just 3 years ago, barely half the students came to school regularly. Now, the school's attendance rate is above 90%. That's higher than the state average. It's a source of pride for Brown, who took over as principal in 2022.
I was very happy. I was very pleased. But more proud of the kids and the parents for their support and believing in Norris.
The leader of South Dakota's education department sees the success at Norris. The leadership and cultural engagement are important parts of that, Joseph Graves says.
And so now we want to see what kind of results this produces. We have the attendance, we have the drops in chronic absenteeism. Now we want to see what's going to happen with those proficiency rates and the graduation rates.
The school is on a gravel road about a half hour from other schools in the White River School District. Its isolation makes it difficult to hire and recruit teachers. In a small community, it takes everyone to keep students involved, Brown says. Some teachers have multiple grade levels in one classroom. The school's head custodian and office administrator are also bus drivers, and Brown steps in at lunchtime to help serve food. He also finds ways to make Lakota culture and language an important part of every student's day. Students sing every morning. Brown teaches Lakota studies to each grade once a week and started the school's first drum group, the Black Pipe Singers. For National Native News, I'm Megan O'Brien.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Suzanne Potter, Sharon Sabata, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.